Thank you, Arctic Acoustic. I love the music. Welcome back to Hanging with History. This is Season 1, That Miracle That Happened, That One Time. And this is Episode 97, The 7 Years' War, Part 3, Second 100 Years' War, Part 27. We wrapped up the war in Central Europe last episode with Frederick's two miracles, and Frederick was never challenged from the West again after the Battle of Rossbach. But you know, it didn't have to go that way. It almost didn't go that way. The French could have conquered Hanover, and they could have used that as both leverage against England at the peace negotiations, the way they used Flanders in the last war, and as a secure base to attack Frederick from the West. And you have to give it to the French for trying. You're going to see there are going to be 5 invasions of Hanover. And to kick it off, in 1757, most of the French army, not earmarked to invade England, invaded Hanover. They came with 80,000 men, commanded by a grandson of Louis XIV's highly competent war minister, Louvois. To meet them was a motley force of some 40,000 Hanoverians, Hessians, Brunswickers, and even a few battalions of Prussians. Though the Prussians would be recalled to Prussia after Frederick's defeat at Kolin by the Austrians. So the French had all the advantages, and with their superior numbers, ranged far and wide, taking Emden in the north, the port where most English Hanoverian trade moved, and Cassel in the south, the capital of Hesse Cassel. Eventually, the main French force, with 60,000 men, met the main Hanoverian force of 35,000 at the Battle of Hastenbach. Though I prefer it to be named the Battle of Hamelin, where nearby the Pied Piper played. Everyone got everything wrong that day. The Hanoverians were commanded by the youngest son of King George II of England and the Elector of Hanover, William Augustus, usually known by the title the Duke of Cumberland, with the nickname of the Butcher, though that nickname originated with his Tory political enemies. His reputation as a general is not great these days, but it was very great after Culloden in 1746. Yeah, Handel wrote The Conquering Hero Comes about Cumberland, but on the day of Hamelin, he made one good deployment and one bad one, and then a spectacularly bad move. His right and center were well placed in strong positions, with his center consisting of a grand battery protected by grenadiers and some infantry reserves. The mistake was to think a large hill on the left was enough to protect that flank. He only put a few light infantry companies up there, not even a full regiment. The French, with their superior numbers, sent several regiments up the hill, which turned out to be not impassable to form troops after all. In the center, the French launched several attacks against the Grand Battery, which all failed. Hundreds of French bodies littered the ground, and the French decided to order a retreat, seeing the direct attacks were hopeless. The French took high losses in these attacks, over 2,000 men, and were not going to waste any more. And that's when Cumberland made his big mistake. He moved the infantry reserves protecting the guns over to the hill to retake it. Furthermore, he did it in a way that the French could see it. So the French unretreated and now threatened the weakened center, and so Cumberland realized he had to retreat, even though his reserves had retaken the hill. The Hanoverian army, though, was still intact, though a bit demoralized. The French have many fortresses to subdue all over western Germany, so they and Cumberland signed a peace deal where Hanover's essentially surrendered. Pitt reacts to George II with a, "Your Majesty, see, here's the thing. We can't have your retarded children losing the war for us." This isn't fair, but George II is furious with his son also, so they give command to Ferdinand, Prince of Brunswick, and send about 9,000 British troops to retake Emden and help out. And more British troops will be sent later. Now, Ferdinand, this is a high-quality general. He's one of Frederick the Great's closest personal friends. Has fought in 6 battles, and we've covered 4 of them, Mollwitz, Suhr, Lobositz, and Rossbach. So in 1758, he takes over this demoralized, defeated Hanoverian army, regales them with tales of French atrocities in Hanover, some of which are true, has some Prussian infantry with him, and they turn the tables and start attacking the French. Retaking Hanover, crossing the Rhine, I should mention the French are seriously distracted by rumors of a British landing on the Channel coast at this time. Ferdinand crosses the Rhine, and now the French are more than a little upset, and their army is still a lot larger than Ferdinand's, just less aggressive. Now the French are commanded by Louis de Bourbon, yes, a cousin of the King of France, which is almost never a good idea, and at the Battle of Krefeld, he makes the same kind of mistake Cumberland made at Hastenbeck. His center is strong, sitting behind a canal. Ferdinand feints to the right, but his main attack is a far-ranging move against the left. And Louis has no excuse here. He has plenty of troops to protect his flanks. He outnumbers Ferdinand dramatically, and when the Allied troops show up on the far left, he reacts too slowly. He's literally at dinner, the midday meal, and some versions of the story have his staff unwilling to interrupt his dinner to give him the news of the Prussian maneuver around the left flank. True or not, the French launch some desperate attacks to slow the Allies down and take about 3,000 casualties doing so, but are able to retreat, and poor Louis resigns in disgrace. But math is actually the more powerful force. This lightning advance across western Germany has gone beyond the ability of Hanover's logistical train, so they return to Hanover and prepare the logistics for 1759, the Annus Mirabilis, though it was unsuspected at the time. But the French also prepare and build up large forces, larger forces than the Allies. Ferdinand's first efforts in 1759 are unsuccessful. The Duc de Broglie successfully defends at the Battle of Bergen. Just as a tangent, this Duc de Broglie is the great-great-great-great, if that's right, grandfather of Louis Broglie, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist who made an important contribution to the quantum theory with the equation that the wavelength of a particle is Planck's constant over mass times velocity. I spent a little time with this equation recently, and I'm pretty sure I don't actually understand it, but neither did other physicists at the time. By the way, I heard this story like 30 years ago. Here it goes. And people doubted an actual aristocrat from a famous family could possibly make a contribution to the far frontier of human intellect. Another puzzled physicist passed on the equation to Einstein, who supposedly, in only a few minutes, said something like, "Yes, this is right." And then the dual wave-particle nature of fundamental particles was proven experimentally the next year in 1925. End tangent. Anyway, a large French force is gathered to invade Hanover, and Ferdinand spends his time retreating until he finally decides to face the French at Minden on the 1st of August. Now, Minden is famous in British military culture, and it is truly surprising. First of all, the British soldiers spent the night near hedges of wild roses, which many of them cut and used to decorate their helmets and clothes. 18th century uniforms were pretty splendid as it was. Their movements were choreography, and now they are choreographed flower arrangements. The French have the numbers, and they've been winning all year, but they're probably not feeling great about their position that day. They spent the night before crossing streams and marshes on pontoon bridges, some of which are just rowboats tied together. They deploy in the plain of Minden with the swamp at their back, a situation where retreat would be a challenge. They also have a weird deployment with their cavalry in the center and infantry deployed on the wings. This is the opposite of the traditional deployment. The infantry has orders to attack, but as is often the case, nothing much happens. Now, I suppose a little digression on giving orders on an 18th century battlefield is warranted here. There are no radios, there are few signals. Most orders have to be delivered in person by a member of the commander's informal staff. And the staff is usually informal. We don't have a general staff in the way that we would think of it in the 19th century. So orders would basically be carried by a writer, and they'd be written with the carrier possibly delivering a little bit of extra color. The 18th century battlefield just wasn't a highly efficient place for a lot of armies. And orders would go down a chain. The commander of the army sends an order to the army wing commander, who might send it down to a subcommand, which then might go directly to a maneuver unit. So naturally, there are a lot of opportunities to get the order screwed up. Everything depends on the horse and the rider. And so you can imagine a situation where you give a relatively simple order that's asking for information or ordering a new formation to be adopted. And then half an hour later, you see an opportunity and you'd like to give the subordinate unit an order to attack. It will happen sometimes that the second order will arrive before the first order, and they don't say disregard the prior order. This will cause a great deal of confusion, or the orders can arrive within a couple of minutes of each other. Say the first rider lost a shoe, or stopped for a snack, or to chat with someone along the way. And you can also have people speaking different languages in the chain of transmission. Or you get a case where the commander who receives your order doesn't think it's a wise order, plays for time by asking a question. And these problems are pretty well known to experienced commanders. It's why Marlborough would go in person to the places he anticipated being the hot spots on the battlefield, and he would change his location during the course of a battle to be able to be there to give the orders at the decisive moment and have them obeyed. Otherwise, there was a very good chance orders from up high would not be obeyed. War games of 18th century battlefields, and often including Napoleonic battlefields, often require the meeting of some probability test to see if an order is going to be obeyed or not on the simulated battlefield. A relatively poor commander might have a less than 20% chance of an order to attack being obeyed the first time, so that it has to be repeated. Someone like Napoleon might have something more like an 80 or 90% chance of an order being obeyed, depending on what year it is, what campaign. So it's not really surprising that one of the infantry-heavy flanks received orders to attack, and yet nothing happened. It's actually a really common outcome. Okay, end digression. On the Allied side, the British infantry, only 6 regiments, so less than 6,000 men, are given orders that are key to the legend. They are told to advance upon the beat of a drum as a signal from Ferdinand. But after passing through 3 different generals in 3 different languages, the order is received as advance to the beat of a drum. So start playing your drums and attack. And so, unsupported, they do the unbelievable, actually shocking. They advance against the French cavalry and artillery. So the French artillery begins slaughtering them, and the French cavalry charges them. Right, that should be a nice opening to the battle for the French, except the British fire, delivered at point-blank range, 30 yards, stops them. Well, that's okay. The next line of French cavalry charges them. Same result. Lots of dead horses piling up all over. Then the French infantry attacks from the flank. Ferdinand starts supporting this surprising attack with his artillery, a couple of Hanoverian battalions too, followed by more infantry supporting the British flanks, and he orders his cavalry to attack. His cavalry, commanded by Lord Sackville, a favorite of the future George III, does nothing, not a thing. The French infantry flanking attacks are beaten off by the British infantry and supporting artillery. There's an atmosphere of everyone is riding to the rescue of these British, which are just stranded in the middle of the French center. Some of the British regiments are suffering 50% casualties, but they keep fighting. The French cavalry reserve, the third line, which included the elite gendarmes and the carabiniers. Now, this is elite heavy cavalry, often the decisive arm. Imagine how this is for the British infantry at this point. They know they are in an unprecedented, very strange situation. Advancing against cavalry is not done. They've been attacked by cavalry twice. Each time, it was probably a relief because at least the artillery isn't killing you. Attacks by superior infantry forces as well. Each time, plunged into a literal hellish landscape of fire, smoke, screaming, and death. And they've survived each one. Well, in some regiments, half of them have. Now the heavy cavalry are coming against you, the best the French army have. The sound of thousands of heavy horses, trumpets blowing the charge, the very earth beneath your feet trembling. If your knees tremble, if your fingers tremble, and you can't shoot straight, it will all end right here. But somehow, the British platoon fire, straight and steady, at short range, for the longest minute and a half of their lives, stops the heavy cavalry. Another French infantry attack is launched, and another. Each time, the steady British fire is too much for the French. They retreat. Now is the time for Sackville's cavalry to save the day. They do nothing. The second in command, Granby, furiously tries to lead the charge. Sackville orders him to desist. The French are retreating, but still vulnerable, and the British light artillery follow to the edge of the plain, and some Prussian dragoons do some slaughter as they crowd the fragile bridges. But no major cavalry charge to deliver the coup de grace. French losses are 7,000 men on the day, rising to 11,000 in a few days out of what started as a 41,000-man army. All these elements, the mistaken advance at the beginning, the heroism, the incredible heroism of the British infantry to hold fast, despite huge losses and the psychological pressure of being attacked over and over again, the drama and defeat of attack by the elite French forces, with the touching, folksy element of the wild roses and the wistful could-have-been, should-have-been failure of the cavalry. It's a story with everything. The French marshal bitterly complains, quote, "I have seen what I never thought to be possible. A single line of infantry break through three lines of cavalry, ranked in order of battle, and tumble them to ruin," unquote. Now, there are details here that may not be true. The last quote is something Thomas Carlyle got from a German source, and we love Carlyle mainly because he's such a great writer and seemed to understand something of the human soul, not because he was always accurate. But the heroism and superhuman performance of the British infantry was certainly true. And then there's the matter of Lord Sackville. And of course, Tolkien would have known the name Sackville when he made the Sackville Bagginses. Historians' views of him are decidedly mixed, and he matters because under the title of Lord Germain, the same man, he directed the British strategy in the American War of Independence as colonial secretary for Lord North and George III. He's responsible for the strategy that got Burgoyne captured at Saratoga, though not the execution of it, of course. Anyway, he was court-martialed, merely dismissed, not shot, like Admiral Byng. The testimony at his court-martial was full of contradictions. Did he cause a 90-minute delay? 45 minutes? Or only 8 minutes, as he claimed? Did they have to wait for the Saxe-Gotha infantry to move, or could they have gone around? Could they, or could they not, move through the woods? What were their actual orders? They did factually get 3 contradictory orders, but also went through the process of person-to-person transmission in multiple languages. Ferdinand said that if Granby had been in command, the victory would have been even greater. It was really the news of it arriving in London on August 8 that brought the British into awareness that 1759 was something special, where Horatio Walpole, son of our beloved Robert Walpole, another really inaccurate primary source who we quote all the time because he was such a good writer, said, quote, "Our bells are worn threadbare with ringing for victories," unquote. The next year, 1760, the French tried another invasion with a huge army, but were defeated at Warburg, which this time featured an impetuous cavalry charge by Granby and the British cavalry. I believe he lost his wig in the affray. In 1761, another French invasion, but they were defeated at Willinghausen, and they also launched an offensive in 1752, but you're beginning to see a pattern here. Despite large armies, sometimes over 100,000 men, the French are regularly defeated by a plucky little mixed English-German army led by Ferdinand. This time, the French are beaten at Wilhelmstadt. This is the 4th year in a row. This is a humiliation for France and a source of jubilation for Britain. At sea, 1757 and 1758 saw Pitt's strategy of amphibious landings on the French coast. There were 3 of these raids, all slightly successful, no disasters, though 800 men were lost in one screw-up. This effort was heavily criticized at the time, but when I look at the results, hundreds of French ships burned in the harbors at Saint-Malo and Cherbourg, privateers burned, merchant ships and invasion barges, and even a few warships under construction, It seems pretty good, but the sneer at the time was that it was, quote, breaking windows with guineas, unquote, which was kind of on the nose since by design, these raids couldn't achieve anything strategic, and the French had huge forces on the coast anyway, in the hopes of invading England. So let's get to that French invasion. A close blockade, which was demonstrably working and wrecking French commerce, meant that the French needed to win a sea battle or two to have any chance at invasion. The usual thing is to try to combine the Mediterranean fleet with the Atlantic fleet at Brest. There is no major naval base in the Channel. Remember, this issue crops up in 1779, episode 86. But the French were distracted by the English capture of Guadeloupe, a richer spice island than all the British Leeward Islands put together. So they send 18 ships of the 21 in their Mediterranean fleet to reinforce the Caribbean. So this reads like a major strategic error. They have to somehow slip past the British fleet in Gibraltar. A major strategic error because they're no longer pursuing the strategy that has a chance of winning the war. Now, this would make a great movie. The British fleet is undergoing a refitting in Gibraltar. Sails off, many yards and masts off, even stores loaded all over the decks. One ship of the line had its gun deck filled with casks. The men and most officers are ashore. The French are sneaking past in the dark of the night, but the guard frigate sees them and sends word. Despite being totally unprepared, some 15 British ships are warping out of the harbor 3 hours later. Only 6 ships had their captains. All are undermanned. All kinds of furious preparation for battle is happening under junior officers. The French are under orders to avoid a battle, and the French Admiral Laclus orders a turn in course. And of course, in the dark of the night, half the French fleet misses the order. So the next day, the French are seriously outnumbered when the British actually do catch them. Only 2 French ships escape. All the rest are captured or burned. The British lose only 56 men, despite taking huge risks, including violating Portuguese neutrality. This Battle of Lagos happens 17 days after Minden in the Annus Mirabilis. The fall of Quebec happened on the 13th of September. On November 20th, we get a battle resulting from a French invasion attempt. The French are thinking Scotland this time, now that the Mediterranean fleet is not available. Remember, we established that God will only destroy an invasion fleet heading for England. It's possible to invade Scotland. This is 17,000 men with 100 transport ships in the Loire estuary. The fleet from Brest is going to come out and help these guys get past a blockading force of 5 50-gun ships and 9 frigates. The Brest fleet is 21 ships of the line, so this should do the job. Now, the Brest fleet is blockaded, but this is the North Atlantic. Just wait for a gale. Won't be long. Oh, yes, there it is. The blockading fleet under Admiral Hawke is blown away. The Brest fleet slips out and chases off those nasty little 50-gun ships. Now, these little guys are commanded by a canny commodore who retreats to both the north and south, and the French split their forces to pursue. So when Hawke comes back with 21 ships of the line, the French are scattered, and trying to fight would be foolish. So they sail into Quiberon Bay. A westerly gale blows up. They should be safe, right? The bay is protected by reefs and shoals. This is known as an iron-bound coast. The British would have to be fools to try sailing in there in the teeth of a westerly gale. But this is Hawke, and of course, he attacks anyway. He does, in fact, lose 2 ships to the rocks, but the French fleet is essentially ruined with 6 ships destroyed, 1 captured, 9 manage to slip away in the dark, and 6 are trapped upriver for the next 2 years. There will not be an invasion after all. The British are really in control of the seas now. They seize Martinique in the Caribbean, because it's another productive sugar island and the last major French possession south of Haiti, which they call Saint-Domingue. Back then, the Brabant of Spain and France signed another family pact in August 1761, their third, with the plan of waiting until the treasure fleet crosses the Atlantic safely, and then they would invade Portugal. with hindsight, this seems like a very bad plan. Pitt refuses to wait for Spain to declare war, though most of the British government is reluctant. And Pitt resigns over this issue. They should have listened to Pitt because in December, the Spanish seize all British ships and goods in Spain, so finally the British declare war on Spain, January 1762, and very quickly blockade the Spanish coast as well. The Spanish lose Havana and Manila in 1762, though the British are unable to expand much outside the two cities. The Havana campaign is interesting. Their initial plan is pretty good. Ships coming from the east through dangerous shoal waters where the Spanish do not expect attack. So surprise is achieved, but beyond that, it's obvious they had terrible intelligence on the primary port in Spanish America. And it actually came from an admiral who visited the place, so it's mysterious for us to understand how they missed such important features. They misunderstood the nature of the fortifications around Havana, causing them to waste weeks in a pointless siege of the strongest fort when they could have swept directly into the city on the first day. And the British almost lost as tropical fevers sickened and killed most of the original landing force. A reinforcement from colonial America of 4,000 troops arrived late, and being relatively healthy made the continuing siege possible. And finally, in the storming of the fortress, the volunteer Forlorn Hope has to squeeze through a barely 5-foot-wide opening. Usually this is a suicide mission. Instead, they quickly kill and capture the Spanish garrison with a loss of only 4 men. Again, we see the British as super high-quality infantry with poor generals. The records show the army commander brazenly trying to shake down the civil authorities for purely personal enrichment. This seems to be known about by the other high-ranking officers and to be disapproved of by them, but they do nothing to stop it. So there's another good indicator of where the upper leadership is morally, tying back to the long-term effects of corruption. As is tradition, Havana was made to pay tribute, quite apart from the army commander's gambit, and 12 ships of the line are captured or sunk, so there's considerable prize money for all the survivors. The plan was they should go and capture New Orleans next, but the hospitals are full. And peace will be signed on the following January 1763, so no time for more operations to occur. Now, I just have to mention the 3 attempted invasions of Portugal. This was Spain's most reasonable hope, and France had promised to give compensation for losses to the British. This promise is why France gives the truncated remains of Louisiana to Spain after the war. Spain's plan is a 3-pronged invasion of Portugal, which has very little in the way of an army at this time because all spare public revenues are going into the rebuilding of Lisbon after the devastating 1755 earthquake. The Spanish intend to invade the north, center, and the south, and Spain too, much like Russia, turns out to be bad at math. The northern forces are ready first, but there's a failure in planning. They forgot all about the military enlightenment principles we've been discussing and do not have a baggage train of supplies. They just intend to buy from the locals. Now, Portugal's only about 50 miles wide, east-west, so no problem, right? Well, after a couple of atrocities, yeah, they forgot about the military enlightenment. The Portuguese people rise up against the Spanish and essentially beat them with just local forces. They deny local supplies and destroy attempts to supply from Spain. The Spanish forces go hungry. The Spanish invade with 23,000 men, but quickly find their attempts to supply themselves from Spain have to be very heavily guarded, and there are less than 5,000 men available by the time they finally reach Porto. The rest are poorly trying to defend the supply lines. The local militia and peasants are able to defeat these Spaniards at the Battle of Porto. And we were just in Porto, and I can tell you the locals are still proud of their achievement. This is one of those moments where the people in arms overcome a professional military. And a joint Portuguese-British force commanded by another northern German prince, this seems to be a winning formula, attacks and destroys the supplies for the southern thrust, which never happens as a result. The central thrust is supplemented by 15,000 or so French troops and is much more successful, but it's still halted outside Lisbon with British help, and the Portuguese are able, people in arms style, to block supplies coming from this large 42,000-man Spanish and French force. The Spanish-French, demoralized and hungry, retreat back into Spain with heavy losses. So we have a peace treaty in 1763, which seems like it settles the whole French-British rivalry. French America, including Canada, east of the Mississippi, goes to Britain. West of the Mississippi goes to Spain. Spanish Florida goes to England in return for the evacuation of Havana and Manila. Now, Pitt's resigned. This will be a problem later. Boot, George III's favorite, is trying to decide how much to ask for. He's misled in a couple of ways. He gets a report on French finances in 1762, which makes him think the French can continue fighting. So all those times we've talked about the state of French finances being a national secret because their enemies could exploit it, here's a case where we see that this strategy of keeping French finances secret actually worked out for France in the short term. Boots also concerned about the British national debt, which has risen to new heights. It was £55 million in 1755, but £132 million by 1763. It's unprecedented. No one's ever had debts like this before that they know about, so no one knows what's going to happen. The other big problem was how much to humiliate France. The London mob and Pitt argued for maximalist approach, but Boot wanted a faster peace because the French wouldn't necessarily agree if they had to lose everything. As a consequence, he gave back Martinique and Guadeloupe and St. Lucia. Also, the French rights in the Newfoundland fisheries, including those two little islands France still has there to this day. Pitt argued this was a strategic mistake as it yielded £500,000 in annual profit and provided a naval training ground for France's 14,000 fishermen. All true. Part of the thinking was that if Britain kept all its gains, she could see Europe united against her. This may well have been correct, but it appears that Boot was just eager to end the war, and this was the price of a quick peace. Now, the list of British gains is impressive. Here it comes. All of North America, ranging from Hudson's Bay down south to Florida, including everything east of the Mississippi, including the Great Lakes region, Canada, Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, Illinois, all of it, in the Caribbean, Tobago, St. Vincent, Grenada, Dominica, also Senegal, and Menorca. In India, the French were not allowed to station troops or build fortifications, essentially ceding the subcontinent. So with this peace, Britain goes from being one of the European colonial powers to being the predominant imperial power. And nevertheless, England ends up alone. The Dutch were neutral, and now very much not pro-British. The Prussians held resentments against Britain for trying to force them into a peace before the Second Miracle and cutting off their subsidies. George III was weirdly anti-Frederick, possibly because of Frederick's double dealing in the War of the Austrian Succession, possibly from Frederick's atheism, possibly his homosexuality. George was religiously conventional for the time, although you could still be a friend of George and be either double-dealing, atheist, or homosexual, you could not be all three. So possibly it was because Frederick was all three. As Macassey puts it, quote, "Britain had crushed her enemies, but lost her friends," unquote. From Andrew Roberts, the last king of America, in internal discussions about peace terms, the Duke of Bedford was thinking about keeping Guadeloupe and returning Canada because, quote, "I do not know whether the neighborhood of the French to our northern colonies was not the greatest security of their dependence upon the mother country, who, I fear, will be slighted by them when their apprehensions about the French are removed," unquote. Oh, Bedford, you were so close, you almost got it. Now with France gone, there was a plan for protecting North America. General Amherst estimated 10,000 troops, which was tested immediately, as in 1763 we saw Pontiac's War, which lasted 2 years in the backcountry of Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia. So 10,000 troops to keep an eye on the Native Americans, the French Canadians, Catholics, you know, can't be too careful, and guard East and West Florida. And the British just sort of assumed the whole thing would run like Ireland, where the Irish paid for the British garrisons and government and the English taxpayer did not. After all, why not? This whole defense apparatus seemed like it would cost £214,000 per year. The colonies with a population of about 2.5 million people, a quarter of them are slaves, so it's about 1.9 million free people. Do the math, a bit over 2 shillings per person per year. North America could be defended, and North Americans could still be the lowest taxed people on earth. Both things would be true. The sum was so small that no one in Booth's government seemed to even consider it could not be collected. As you know, in the aftermath of the war and its gigantic demobilization, there were huge economic problems. Public expenditure was slashed from £13.5 million a year to £8 million per year. The army reduced from 120,000 to 48,000 now to defend a world empire. The Royal Navy mothballed much of the fleet, badly as it turned out. Many of the newly built ships would rot away. The fiscal assumptions of the time demanded they both cut the debt and the land tax. That's just a little background. The key idea is that no one in London anticipated there would be any resistance to this colonial self-funding. It just made sense, and besides, the colonists would be grateful for British efforts. Expecting gratitude is actually a bad look. Andrew Roberts is careful to point out that British imperialism in this context was never ever intended to be exploitative. It was to confer two-way benefits, and ultimately, there had to be a source of sovereignty, and that concept was king and parliament, and an idea that's been around since 1530 or before, and after the Glorious Revolution, put in the context of the Bill of Rights. Right, we did the 3-episode Age of Walpole arc on how that parliamentary government got to be stabilized and the new concept of it brought to fruition. But, you know, the parliament in practice never really interfered in colonial government. The colonies instead developed their own institutions, their own legislatures, adapting British practices to suit local needs. Quote, Edmund Burke dubbed this practice salutary neglect, the de facto devolution of autonomy from the imperial center to its colonial peripheries, unquote. Nevertheless, the Booth government didn't expect any trouble from the colonies as the world transitioned to peace. Andrew Roberts makes the case that this was a reasonable expectation. But the problem of taxing the colonies was who would do the taxing. Could Parliament tax the colonies? By what right? What does that imply? Can Parliament legislate everything? Override our local governments? By what right? How does sovereignty over North America lie in Parliament? It's actually a tough argument to make. Other kinds of solutions like local sovereignty under the king were not conceived and suggested until they were too late. And this is a problem that arises from rule by mediocrities, which government under George III typically was until 1782. They didn't recognize the enormous potential of America. Fully 2/3 of Americans owned land, compared to 20% of Britons. 2/3 were literate, more than in England. 2/3 had the vote versus 1/8. The population was doubling every 25 years, 4 times faster than Britain. Eventually, the local political center of gravity of the empire would have to switch to North America, but only Benjamin Franklin, who was good at math, seemed to realize this. Half British merchant shipping was devoted to the North American trade, with American exports doubling to £1.5 million and imports more than that. This trade deficit was financed by American debt to Britain, which grew to £4 million by 1772. More Andrew Roberts, quote, one of the reasons the British politicians failed to comprehend that Americans would soon be agitating for nationhood was the paradoxical one, considering the propaganda of the independence movement 12 years later, that they were not being persecuted in any discernible way. the colonists were the least oppressed of all the peoples of the earth, politically, economically, and nationally. The favorable conditions of frontier life had brought Milton's and Locke's teachings to faster and fuller fruition in the colonies than in the mother country, unquote. That's about attitude and culture. Economically, Americans were barely taxed at all compared to the British. From the London perspective, the mercantile assumption that trade equals power, an idea put forth by our old friend Colbert under Louis XIV, and that's because profits from trade could be turned via taxation into war material. Therefore, it was in the interest of all Britons, British and American, to do as much trade as possible with each other, rather than with the French or Dutch. Thus, the mercantilist policies followed by London were actually anti-French, not anti-American. So when Americans started complaining, again, London was taken unawares and didn't take it seriously. So here we are in a situation where there is serious conflict between Americans and London over a range of issues. Westward expansion is one because that caused wars with the Native Americans, many of whom were allies in the last war. And there was, of course, the endemic smuggling of French and Dutch goods, of course, the tax and spend power of Parliament versus colonial assemblies, questions of religious rights, what are the powers of royally appointed governors. All these issues needed to be rethought and settled for potentially huge gains for a united empire. But instead, we see elites being terrible, the normal course of history. Quote, Westminster now entered into a 7-year period of endemic factionalism and political strife in which governance and taxation of Americans became a political dispute between shifting alliances of competing politicians, and genuine statesmanship was in very short supply, unquote. That's a beautiful summary of his 700-page book. Genuine statesmanship was in very short supply. London's American policy was a token in a game of stupid politics we're all familiar with. We'll close the episode with something hilarious and the greatest piece of corruption in the 18th century. Henry Fox, father of Charles Fox, was paymaster general during the war, and guess what he did? He ran the army's finances through his personal bank accounts in London, ending up with £500,000 profit personally. I know that seems utterly insane. Something over $1 billion functionally today. Boot, thanking Fox for helping get the Treaty of Paris signed, thanked Fox for, quote, a spirit of generosity that I can never forget. The vessel's safe in harbor, unquote.
Okay, we'll figure it out.
All right, Cammie, we just finished off episode 97, finished off the 7 Years' War, and started to explore the issues that would lead to the American Revolutionary War.
Yes, we finished 7 Years' War, but we're going into another war? I'm sorry, it seems like
it's war the second is 100
all
years war.
We're talking about lately.
We are going to take a break. As soon as we finish the run-up to the American Revolutionary War in episode 98 and 99... we'll switch over to what was the Industrial Revolution really? And that'll be a long, long arc before we get back to Napoleon.
So that's episode 100. That's like how we're
celebrating. Episode 100.
How we're celebrating.
Starting to write it today. Yeah.
Triple digits. Getting off wars for a bit.
Yep. We'll be off wars for a long time.
I'll take that. This war stuff.
It's very important to the development of European states, European politics, and the structure of economies that, you know, have to be geared to fight and win these wars.
I did really enjoy your explanation about how orders were sent out during wars this time.
Oh, good.
It wasn't, you know, it's not like now when communications are almost instantaneous and direct to who you want to go to. But the whole sending them out on rioters, and if something happened to that rioter, you didn't even mention what if they got...
oh, yeah,
captured,
sure.
Or
cannonball takes their head off.
Yeah, killed on the way. Then the orders are never, ever seen by the other side. And the chain of commands. Why so many levels of chain of command where the orders gave me just pocketed? Someone doesn't like them. They might not get passed along.
Well, that happens, too. I mean, I wasn't kidding when I said that the first time you give an order, if you're not a really good general, the odds of it being obeyed, you know, might only be 20%.
That's amazing to me. That much of it could just be ignored. And you have to wonder how things may have changed in many of these battles.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes there are status differences between subordinates. And sometimes someone of higher status, higher social rank, greater presence, simply would refuse to acknowledge an order from a lower level leader. That's why a lot of these generals, they're all dukes or cousins of the king.
And so a lot of it is not even what the orders are, but who's looking at them.
But notable times. And of course, any of that sort of thing getting in the way of tens of thousands of men trying to fight and kill each other in countries trying to achieve their long-term objectives, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, well, and once the orders actually get where they're supposed to be going, they may be obsolete. Things could have changed completely.
Absolutely, yeah, because I didn't mention the time factor, but you're right, because the events change by the time the order gets there. It might not be the right order anymore. That's why, you know, super high quality leaders like Marlborough would be aware of these kind of problems, would do things in a non-standard way to make sure that their orders got obeyed. Napoleon, he came up with a staff system with his aides-de-camp that were all these just highly intelligent young officers with the potential to be marshals. His ability to get orders out efficiently and have them obeyed, one of the things that made the French army so fearsome on the Napoleonic battlefields.
French army is being fearsome. But then it seems like they went through some really bad years. I mean, 1760 through.
Yeah, these invasions.
Defeated over and over again.
Yeah. Five invasions of Hanover, each one being defeated by outnumbered forces of kind of scraped together German and British forces.
The French losing so many battles and attempts in a row, people must have started to kind of disregard their power. And here comes the French again kind of thing. Is that not true? It's just a picture I have in my mind.
That seems like a natural inference to draw. But no, I don't really think that was true. The French took themselves seriously. The British took them seriously. The British obviously were overconfident after the Seven Years' War. And they were not as prepared as they should have been for the French intervention in the American Revolutionary War. And so that was the greatest British loss of the Second Hundred Years' War. It was the American Revolutionary War, which we covered in episode 86. And overconfidence and bad planning, lack of strategic vision. Even though the entire time, the quality of the British infantry never faded. It was always there. They were always the best.
God will only stop or destroy an army going to England, huh?
Yeah, so I mean, I've made that kind of a theme because, you know, you start with 1589 with the first Spanish Armada, and we have a total, including the War of the Quadruple Alliance, of four invasion attempts from Spain. Then we have two direct invasion attempts from France, but speaking more broadly, there were five invasion attempts from France. And the only ones that didn't get wiped by a storm were the ones that went to Ireland and Scotland.
Hmm.
If they tried to go to England.
Get knocked out, huh?
Yeah, the Spanish Armada, of course, was beaten at Gravelines and then made their long fleeing return to Spain, all the way around Scotland. A crazy voyage. And they got whacked by a storm, but only at the end. But three other Spanish invasion attempts of England were destroyed by storm before they, you know, barely much left sea. The 1744 invasion was like as soon as they left port, bam, 10 ships sink, seven of them founder, all hands lost. In the 1779 invasion, I mean, obviously people arguing over what the right spot to invade is slowed everything down. But then when they finally decided, you know, a gale comes up and sweeps them out past England, out into the Atlantic, out into the Irish Sea.
Well, with those kinds of things happening, it must have been quite a deterrent with people believing that God will only stop or destroy an army going to England. That in itself must have deterred a few people from...
Well, no, it didn't seem to, because they sure kept trying.
Or at least scared the guys enough that maybe they weren't.
Well, certainly. I mean, we do have Paul Kennedy's observation that the French Navy seemed to be psychologically defeated in all of these wars before the fighting actually begins.
And then your discussion of Portugal.
Yeah, the people in arms defeating the Spanish army.
That's pretty amazing. And yes, they are still proud of it. You see pieces of that history to this day there.
Yeah, absolutely. But, the attitudes, their nicknames for themselves. And
yeah, that kind of
Invictus.
Thing.
There was only the one attack on Porto, but yeah, simultaneously there was a thrust towards Lisbon that got defeated. The one in the south got defeated by an aggressive Anglo-Portuguese attack on their staging area.
So when the smoke is clearing, it sounds like the world largely belongs to Britain.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't started to split up Africa yet, and they haven't started the domination of China, but North America, much more of the Caribbean. Just two trading posts in Africa, but then the domination over India is beginning. The episode before, we covered how the British, kind of like a mercenary army acting on behalf of someone who wanted to overthrow the Nawab and make himself the Nawab, end up conquering Bengal, sort of. There's still a Nawab. The Nawab now has to answer to the company. And then holding off, again, another Annus Mirabilis thing in 1759, defeating the Dutch East India Company's invasion of Bengal. And the English did capture Manila, but didn't really spread into the hinterland in the Philippines. And they did give Manila back to the Spanish.
So who said, and you used the quote, but who said Britain crushed her enemies but lost her friends?
Oh, it was a historian, last name of Maxey. Crushed her enemies but lost her friends. And, you know, we see that in the War of the American Revolution. The Dutch end up supporting the Americans. They become the main arms dealers until the French intervene. And eventually, in the course of the thing, the British end up fighting the Americans, the Spanish, the French, and the Dutch.
Yeah, they were really busy fighting.
The Dutch lost the most out of all this, but the War of American Independence didn't just have the 13 colonies break off and become separate countries, but it also cost England Florida and a couple of Caribbean islands as well. If they hadn't won the Battle of the Sons at the end, they would probably have had to give up even more.
So, not being a historian, it seemed odd for me to hear that the colonists were the least oppressed in pretty much the entire earth. And
yeah, that's a fair statement.
Weren't really taxed heavily, because my history was all about how the colonists were mad about the high taxes and taxation without representation.
Well, we've got two episodes coming up about that. See, it's a lot more complicated than simply what the amount of taxation is. See, if you say what the amount of taxation is, the Americans are less taxed than basically anybody. And obviously, they're freer. An actual majority of European-descended males could vote. They make their own rules for almost everything. They are a free people. As I think the quote was, that they were able to bring Milton and Locke's visions to fuller fruition than the mother country. And that's true. The problem is that after the war, there's now a need to spend some money to defend the colonies. And they think it's not a big amount, only £214,000 a year. But how is that going to be done? Who's going to make the kind of coordinating decisions for how that money is going to be raised? And what are the rules going to be? And we've got two episodes covering that coming up, because there's some intellectual, logical quandaries that will just be impossible to solve, that solving would have required a genius, would have required or statesmanship of the highest level. And that genius, that great statesman, will not be found.
Will not be found.
It'd be mediocrities all the way down.
And you close today talking about Henry Fox.
Oh, yeah. He's almost an unbelievable character.
So, yeah, he ran the army's finances through his own bank
account. His own personal bank accounts.
A lot of money.
Oh, yeah. Some of that money just fell out.
It was just
in a corner over there.
Pocket change.
In a box.
But was he not punished for this? Or is that a cliffhanger for next time?
No, he was never punished for this. It was strongly suspected It's a lot more well known now, I think it was, than then, that he made these prophets.
Amazing. Anyone else, anywhere else? I mean, we saw people getting executed for not winning battles, and this guy's lining his pockets.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Wow.
And so, and that fortune was the one that supplied his son, Charles Fox, who became a great radical politician, who was sometimes even in government, despite George III, you know, hating and despising him.
But when you have a king's ransom in your coffers, yeah.
That's one way to get rich.
Oh my goodness, that just amazes me that there was nothing bad happened to him after that.
Yeah, the concept of auditors had already started to exist. It was invented, it may have been invented in northern Italy, but the Dutch were using it in the VOC. By about this time, they were putting reports together for the directors and the shareholders of the company. But in England, they were only doing these sort of financial reports in arrears. And many times, they were 5 and 6 years in arrears. So,
wow, way behind.
Yeah.
By then, the money could be spent or gone or moved elsewhere, or the person died.
Exactly. And it was often very difficult to reconstruct financial events after the fact.
No computer, and so that was often very poorly done. Yeah.
And it was also the sort of thing that was like, you know, a basic job responsibility that the departments and the ministers had. And it was of a kind where nobody would give them a bribe or a tip to do it. So it was kind of the lowest priority effort. So lowest priority effort by people who can't get fired for not doing it. It's all for the equilibrium. I mean, that's, it's just not going to be done well.
No incentive to do it well.
Okay, so with Henry Fox, the most corrupt man. Oh, in fact, Henry Fox turned down a higher responsibility job because he wanted to remain the paymaster general.
Yeah. Well, I think I would too. He's not stupid.
Probably.
He knew where he's...
Yeah, and nevertheless, you know, he wanted to get an earldom in reward afterward. He only got to be a baron, and he thinks that, you know, he probably wasn't... Yeah, he deserved more.
Maybe he would have liked to have been a king.
Well, his son occasionally gave indirect suggestions that maybe there shouldn't be any king at all.
Uh-huh, so he was a troublemaker.
Not as much as John Wilkes, and we will finally cover John Wilkes in great detail, his whole story arc.
Okay, well, I look forward to hearing more about John Wilkes.
Okay, thanks for coming on the program, Kimmy.
You're welcome.
Please click subscribe or follow on your podcast app. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend about it. If you don't, please tell an enemy. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to discuss anything covered in the episode, please feel free to email me at hangingwithhistorypodcast@gmail.com.